we're looking back at historic flooding in Dane County 1 year ago and taking stock on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kant. Thanks for being here. So recall it had been a rather dry summer in Wisconsin, and then those last 2 weeks of August happened. Record rainfall, neighbors helping neighbors, stack sandbags, news reports of rising water.
Right now at 5, it is flooding like they have never seen before in Dane County.
It's being called a summer's worth of rain in just one day.
Check out Black Earth Creek. It is at its banks along the side of the creek. You can actually see cars getting washed into the creek.
We're looking at the recovery process and what communities can take away when disaster hits home. Were you flooded? What happened? Are you still dealing with problems? Have you helped with cleanup? We're at 800-642-1234. Joe Parisi is Dane County Executive. Joe, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So which parts of Dane County would you say are still dealing with significant issues from last year's flooding?
You know, those that took the hardest hit initially are the places that are still dealing the most with the consequences. You know, there was a lot of attention, you know, as after the storm and as time went on to the chain of lakes through Dane County, and there were certainly issues there. But the folks who took the brunt of the storm and the brunt of the damage were in western Dane County, for example, the village of Mazamani, a small rural village toward the western end of the county. I was there yesterday, and they lost numerous homes to flash flooding and the swelling rivers. So the interesting thing about this event was that there were a number of stages and a number of different types of flooding. There was the initial flash flooding, and that's when we had a tragic loss of life and lost many homes. Then there was the flooding that followed in the days and weeks after as the watershed drained both into the Ahara chain of lakes and through the Sugar River watershed. One interesting kind of example of how this played out was all of the rain that fell in the western edge of the county, Cross Plains area, that drained into the Sugar River watershed. A couple days later, flooded the village of Belleville, which had only received a couple inches of rain. And then all the other rain that went down into the Ahara watershed began to back up into our chain of lakes.
You said you were in Mazamani yesterday. What changes have you seen for these hard-hit communities?
Well, so a number of homes were inundated by the flood, and some folks have rebuilt or are rebuilding. Some folks are back in their homes, but there are a number of homes that are abandoned. And currently the village is waiting upon final word from FEMA on, you know, how much assistance they're going to give in buying out some of these homes where the residents are open to just leaving the home because there's a danger that it could flood again. So there are a lot of folks that are still in limbo. The FEMA process takes a very long time to play out, and folks have been disrupted a lot. But the village has been extremely resilient. They've invested a lot of their own money into repairs. They, like folks around the rest of the county, are looking at their infrastructure and reexamining the needs and how their stormwater engineering will play out, you know, in light of the new reality that we face. And the new reality is that we are, and it's forecast, you know, into the future, we are going to be receiving more of this type of rain as our climate changes, more intense events, a lot more rain all at once. And so we all have to look at our infrastructure and do the best we can to mitigate and adapt.
Talking with Joe Parisi, he's Dane County Executive. We're looking at 1 year after historic flooding hit Dane County, historic rains. Groundwater levels and the high water table, how is Dane County approaching that with groundwater levels currently at a record high?
Yeah, this is the flood that keeps on giving, right? I mean, the rain that we got in Dane County last year, we got about 18 inches above normal. This year, we're already about 8 inches above the norm. And while a lot of the flooding that's visible to folks has receded, we have groundwater that is saturated. And so now when it rains, there's nowhere for the rain to go. And the biggest impact that we've had here is kind of twofold. First of all, fully 10% of our agricultural land is underwater and unplanted. this year. That's a huge loss to our area farmers at a time when they can certainly afford it the least, given the situation in the farm economy now. And for our residential residents in their homes and businesses that have basements, folks are seeing flooded basements who have never had that occur before. It's not just folks who live in floodplains. So we're taking a detailed survey of soil and elevation across the county so that we can provide business owners and homeowners and farmers with new data, updated data, given our new climate reality on who is likely to be susceptible to flooding, who is not in the past.
In response to the historic rainfall, Dane County added more than $18 million to its budget to improve areas that are flood prone. What did those efforts look like?
So it's kind of twofold. First of all, Dane County, as you know, is an incredibly fast growing community. And so because of that, there's a lot of development, and with development comes more impervious surface. So what we have done is focused a portion of those dollars on buying parcels of land to either preserve prairie and wetlands or purchase land and restore prairies and wetlands, because we need to work on being able to keep more of the water where it lands so that it doesn't run off immediately into our streams and lakes. Recently, we bought a 160-acre farm that was slated for residential development, and we instead are going to plant that in prairie and restore a wetland, and it's estimated we will gain a net 5 million gallons of storage capacity from that project. We are also looking at ways to move the water through our chain of lakes faster so it doesn't back up. We have four lakes connected by channels, and if you think of those channels as drains, those drains are clogged with urban runoff, sand, and silt. And so we're going in a multi-year project to dredge those channels so that when the rain and then the water as it drains through the watershed comes into particularly our top lake, Lake Mendota, that then goes through the rest of the chain, that we can move that water through quicker and have a better control over the level of our lakes.
So what have you and Dane County officials learned since last year's historic flooding? What is something you didn't know that you know now and will change going forward?
Well, it's caused us to reexamine a lot of things. I mean, you have to look at it first as far as first responding capability, your emergency operations center and coordinating with municipalities. We've purchased, for example, a number of additional sandbagging machines, a new airboat, because that initial flash flood and that response, we have to be as prepared as possible. And then we're looking at things kind of like the examples I just mentioned, that in this new reality, when we can expect to receive much more rain than we're used to and much quicker, we have to be prepared to not only respond, but to do what we can up front to be able to slow down that rain from getting into our chain of lakes, and then move it through faster. So there's really multiple steps in a flooding process, and we're having to beef up our resources in all of those places.
Joe, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Joe Parisi is the Dane County Executive. We've been talking 1 year after historic floods and historic rainfall hit Dane County. Coming up, a Marquette economist helps us connect the dots on his new research. He looked at climate change skepticism and close gubernatorial elections. We learn what it could mean for economic policy. We'll talk more in just a minute. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're zooming in on behavioral economics now on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and some new research caught our eye, and that is whether there's a correlation between climate change skepticism and close gubernatorial elections. Does a politician's position on the issue of climate change influence your vote? How should our lawmakers use scientific information when adopting policy? Join in around these questions, 800-642-1234. Andrew Meyer is an economist. He's an economics professor at Marquette University studying environmental and behavioral economics. And his new study is titled Elite Influence on Climate Change Skepticism, Evidence from Close Gubernatorial Elections. And it's published in the Journal of the Association of Environmental and Resource Economists. Andrew, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. Happy to be with you.
Okay, so this is a lot to get our arms around here. Political polarization around the issue of climate change that has increased. Your research points to one contributing factor. How can political leaders affect the climate change beliefs on their constituents?
Yeah, it's exactly what I'm looking at in this paper. And so I'm really interested with this research in the effects of political messaging. So if there's a skeptical political leader, do they inject skepticism into the public opinion about whether climate change is real? So I needed some data to try to answer that question. Then I guess the question is, where do we go? Where do we go to find that data? Well, the most visible politician is the president. So maybe we would start there. We would look and see what the president is saying. For example, if President Trump tweets about climate change, does that change the probability that somebody in the U.S. thinks climate change is real? But the problem is it's really difficult to determine in that context because everybody is potentially exposed to that messaging. So in the words of an experimentalist, everybody's treated. There's no control or comparison group. So what I do instead for this research is I go to the states. And at the state level, the most visible politician is probably the governor. And there's a lot of evidence out there showing that there's a big divide between the climate change positions of Democratic and Republican governors, with Republican governors typically denying or remaining silent about climate change, and Democratic governors typically accepting the science of climate change. So, for example, you know, over the period of my study, which ran from 2008 to 2015, there were really only two exceptions where Republican governors spoke out in favor of climate change policy. That was Schwarzenegger in California and Crist in Florida. So what I'm going to do with this research then is I'm going to compare climate change beliefs of people that live in states that had a Republican governor win a close election versus the climate change beliefs of people that live in states where the Democratic governor won a close election. We wouldn't want to just compare climate change beliefs of people in a very red state like Wyoming with those from people in a very blue state like New York. So what I do then is focus in on those really close elections and look at people living in those states. So look at states where the margin of victory for the governor was only a few percentage points.
Mm-hmm.
Then people living in states that went narrowly Democrat for the governor can serve basically as a control group for people living in states that went narrowly Republican. So in a sense, what I do is I take the people in states that were narrowly won by Democrats, and I use them to predict what the climate change beliefs of people in states narrowly won by Republicans would have looked like if a Democrat had won instead.
You're really layering.
Yeah,
it seems like you're layering data on data and looking mm-hmm. where things line up.
Exactly. So it's like nature has given us an experiment, right? It's like the close election provides us with an experiment of a control group and a treatment group, where the treatment group is going to be the states that were won by a Democrat in the close election, and we compare that to the control group of the states where the Democrat won the close election.
We're talking with Andrew Meyer. He's a professor of economics at Marquette University studying environmental and behavioral economics. And we're looking at his new paper that is called Elite Influence on Climate Change Skepticism. Andrew, why elite influence? What do you mean there?
So this elite influence, it's really just the term that's used in the literature to denote high-level politicians, right? So when we talk about elite influence, we're really just looking at top-level political leaders and how their stated opinions, their stances could affect the climate change beliefs of the public.
So some people are skeptical about the human-caused element of climate change. What did the research show when a gubernatorial candidate was skeptical of the human part of the equation?
Right. So first, let me just start, I guess, with the base result of just in general what happens when there is a Republican that wins versus a Democrat that wins, just on the question of do you believe in climate change at all? So if you look at the question of do you believe in climate change at all, when you move from that close Democrat win to that close Republican win, there's actually quite a sharp drop in the probability of a Republican constituent believing in climate change. I don't find an effect on the probability of a Democratic constituent believing in climate change. But then when you move to your question there about the human-caused climate change, in that case, I do find an effect for both Republican and Democratic constituents. So when you move from a close Democratic governor win to a close Republican governor win, there's a drop in the probability of both Democrats and Republicans believing in climate change in those states.
Okay, so our heads are spinning right now, trying to keep up with you.
I know, it's a lot. Yeah, I've been thinking about this for 2 years, and you're trying to catch up in a few minutes, right?
How did you start to think about this? Where did this idea come from to study this?
So I've worked a lot on what drives pro-environmental behavior in general. So in other words, what makes somebody environmentally friendly or not so environmentally friendly. For example, I've looked at how education or local economic conditions impact behavior. And so the research was kind of just naturally drifting towards political influences as I read more about what other people were studying as well. And I think it's also really important for economic policy because, you know, the scientific consensus is that climate change is real. So what economists do is they take the predicted physical impacts of climate change from the scientists' models, and then they translate those into dollar amounts of damage, right? So it's clear from that economics research that climate change would impose some pretty large costs on society. Because of those large costs, it really justifies putting some sort of price on carbon to discourage fossil fuel use through either like a carbon tax or a cap and trade program. But I think that we stand a lower chance of being able to pass that type of climate change policy if political opinion remains skeptical about climate change. So I think that's really how it relates back to economic policy.
Okay, but lawmakers, they're elected to represent and advocate for issues that matter to their constituents. Could these gubernatorial candidates and governors be mirroring the skepticism that is out there among their electorate?
So that's one thing that I can never completely rule out, that there's some mirroring going on, but I think that that's a less likely explanation, and let me try to explain why. So there are several reliable predictors of climate change beliefs, including gender, education, race, age, political affiliation is a big one. Are you Democrat or Republican? And so if politicians are simply reflecting the beliefs of their states, we would expect to see a sharp change in those characteristics that I mentioned at that threshold where it changes from a close Democratic victory to a close Republican victory. Mm. I don't see any evidence of that. Everything aside from the climate change beliefs looks similar. So, you know, that kind of makes me more confident that I'm finding more of a causal result here. That is that it's the politician leading on this issue.
Let's bring in John now, joining us from Sturgeon Bay. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning. A question. I don't know how this could factor in or how this may have factored into your study, but I feel like people in the Democratic Party, when they hear people in the Republican Party, maybe it's the elite like you're talking about, saying they don't believe climate change is a threat, I kind of feel like they more think that, well, they have to believe that climate change is a threat because of all the overwhelming science, but they're choosing to be a skeptic because of some sort of special interest and some sort of dollars that are coming their way because from the oil, gas, whatever it might be. So I don't know that we necessarily believe that they don't think it's real. We believe that they're choosing to put it down on their list of priorities because of other things.
John, thanks. Andrew, there are a lot of competing priorities. There are a lot of influences.
Yeah, you know, that's a really interesting comment. And I think that that speaks to the fact that we really need some more research here to try to understand exactly what's going on. You know, with the setup of this paper that I have, I'm not able to say exactly what the mechanism is as to how people's beliefs are changing. And this is, you know, a survey-based data set. So they're asking people, do you believe in climate change or do you not? So anything that can affect their answer to that, you know, irregardless of what's really in their mind, that's the data that I'm going to be seeing. So I think that that point is a good one.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us and explaining your research.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
Andrew Meyer is a professor of economics at Marquette University. Coming up, a pair of loons in northern Wisconsin recently adopted a mallard chick, and this unique relationship is capturing the hearts of bird enthusiasts. Have you seen pictures or perhaps spotted this pair of loons with their mallard chick? What are your thoughts on the relationship? Join in with your questions about loons, 800-642-1234. We'll talk more about the Loon Project after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're learning about loons on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Loons and mallard ducks are natural rivals, so it took loon experts by surprise earlier this year when a chick was spotted hitching a ride on the back of a loon on a lake in Wisconsin's Northwoods, and it appears a pair of loons became the adopted family of a mallard duck. Do you live near loons and their habitat? What have you observed? How would you describe their behavior? And what questions do you have about loons in Wisconsin? We're at 800-642-1234. Walter Piper directs the Loon Project, which focuses on loons in northern Wisconsin. He's a biology professor at Chapman University in Orange, California. Walter, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. Nice to be with you.
So how'd it come to your attention that this pair of loons in Wisconsin took to this mallard chick?
Well, we cover 120 study lakes each year. We have marked pairs on those study lakes in the northern part of the state, as you said, between Rhinelander and Minocqua. And we routinely visit these lakes and check on the reproductive status of the birds, including whether they're nesting, whether they have chicks themselves, and so forth. And so we visited this particular small lake where this occurred, and noted in mid-May that the pair had two loon eggs and were beginning their incubation. And then about a month later, we returned, and given that the loon incubation period for loon eggs is 28 days, we anticipated that we would find one or two loon chicks there if the pair had been lucky enough to hatch them. And it so happened that we had a novice, someone who was on the study for the first year and had never seen loon chicks, and it was also a rainy day. And so this particular member of our team reported that there was some fluffy thing that must be a loon chick that was with the two loons on the lake on that particular day.
And this fluffy thing wasn't what it was supposed to be.
Well, it wasn't. She did note that it had yellowish markings on it, which wasn't. It's not consistent with what a loon chick looks like. Loons are just all chocolate brown in color. And also that it was picking at vegetation, which loon chicks never do. And so 10 days later, when we had a veteran member of our team visit the lake, she said, "Oh my God, there's a mallard duckling being raised by these two and defended by these two loons."
Oh, so, wow. And so many photographs later, I understand, yeah, we've seen lots of pictures of this. How did this happen?
Well, as I said, the pair was incubating their own eggs and thinking no evil in mid-May, and we know from our detective work, from having visited the nest that they had initiated in mid-May, that at least one of those eggs hatched. You can tell from the breakage pattern of the eggs, of the eggshell fragments, that the egg, at least one of the eggs had hatched, and therefore they certainly had a loon chick at one point, but that loon chick must have been lost within the first day or two, and at the same time they obviously crossed paths with a wayward mallard duckling, that had lost its siblings and mother. Perhaps it hatched late or got isolated in some way, perhaps because of an eagle attack or some other stressful event that occurred. But in any event, the loons were looking to raise something just about the time when this duckling was looking for parents. And so I guess a beautiful thing happened, and they began to care for this duckling like it was their own chick.
But I understand that loons and ducks are rivals of sorts. They don't usually like each other in their territory.
That's right. I mean, rival maybe is a kind word. Loons are stealthy creatures. Of course, they dive, and whereas mallards stay on the surface. And so, actually, what loons often do when they see mallards and especially ducklings is that they sneak up underneath them and attack them. Sometimes kill them, peck them to death, and just leave them. And so, yeah, they are not friends under most natural circumstances. So this makes it all the more peculiar.
We're talking with Walter Piper, director of the Loon Project, studying loons in northern Wisconsin. He's a biology professor at Chapman University. You can join in. Do you live near loons and their habitats? What have you observed? How would you describe their behavior? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Walter, you've been researching loons for decades now. What's it been like for you to see these two loons adopt this mallard duckling and see them flourish together?
Well, it's quite a spectacle. I mean, it's you when you get used to seeing loons with chicks. I mean, loon chicks are cute too, and fluffy, and do all sorts of little funny loon-like things, or try to when they're small. And but you certainly form a certain image of what a young thing should look like that was being raised by adult loons. And so to see this duckling following and attentive to its parents, and to its parents to have its parents defend it vigorously like these parents have been, it's quite an oddity. Kind of sweet and also puzzling, really puzzling from a behavioral standpoint.
So in terms of behavior, what is a typical day like for loons, and how does the mallard duck fit into this?
Well, loons feed their young, their chicks. In fact, all of the food that a young loon chick is brought to that chick by its parents, and so that chick is entirely dependent upon food from its parents. And so loons, when they have young chicks, dive constantly, also are constantly on the lookout for anything that might hurt their chicks, especially bald eagles, which consume a lot of chicks and attack chicks. So loons are attentive parents. They're constantly feeding tiny, tiny fish to their chicks. And strangely, or not strangely, depending on how you look at it, these loons, which adopted this duckling, tried to do the same thing with this duckling, and that is, they expect to feed their young. And ducklings, mallard ducks, on the other hand, feed themselves entirely. They of course follow their mothers in large queues, and of 10-12 ducklings sometimes, but they always feed themselves along shoreline areas, and they dabble, they turn themselves upside down and reach for food for invertebrates and insect larvae and so forth in and around shorelines and vegetation. And so they expect not to be fed. However, this duckling was only too happy, it turned out, to accept fish from its from its parents. And in fact,
hard to resist.
Yeah, I mean, it's a free meal, so what are you going to do? But In fact, it's comical. It's been comical to watch the parents would surface with a fish, and the duckling, which might have been 20 yards away at the time, would rush across the water to snatch the fish out of its parents' bill. So it's delighted to be having these free and unexpected meals.
Well, in the grand scheme of evolution, loons are older than humans. How are loons doing in Wisconsin? Are they thriving?
You know, they have been. The last time we did a very rigorous analysis of the loon population in Wisconsin was about 2008, when we actually ran a population model. And at that point, it looked like loons were doing quite well. The population appeared stable, but there are some storm clouds on the horizon. There has been a recent study by the Audubon Society, by a scientist working with the Audubon Society, that suggested, based on climate change, that the loon population would be greatly reduced and pushed northward in the state by 2050, and that loons would disappear entirely from Wisconsin by 2080. Now, that's a model. And many things happen when temperatures warm up and when rainfall patterns change. And there's so many biological and chemical changes to lakes and to loons' parasites and loons' predators and so forth, that it's hard to be absolutely sure what's going on. But that study concerned me, naturally, and so I ran a few analyses to see how loons were doing, and there are a few warning signs. The brood size, loons either raise one or two chicks, and 30 years ago, about half of all broods in northern Wisconsin were two-chick broods rather than singleton, one-chick broods. And now it's about 80% of all broods are one-chick rather than two-chick broods. So there's been a significant statistical decline in brood size. Also, I very recently looked at the mass of loon chicks, and the masses have been declining. That is, they've been getting lighter at the
same... Oh, you mean their birth weight?
Maybe their birth weight, too. We don't have that.
Okay.
We capture them when they're about 4 or 5 weeks old, and so we can say, okay, on August 3rd in 1997, what was the average weight? And on August 3rd in 2019, what was the average weight of these chicks? And there has been a substantial decline in the mass and therefore the body condition of loon chicks. And so that's another factor that really concerns us. It's puzzling. We don't understand what might be causing it. But in other words, there really are storm clouds on the horizon, and of course there's the creeping human encroachment of various kinds, human recreation and shoreline development and so forth, and angling fatalities that have occurred that concern us. So there really is some substantial reason for concern.
Walter Piper is heading up the Loon Project. He's a biology professor. You can join in 800-642-1234. We'll talk more about loons in just a moment on the Ideas Network. We're talking about loons and an unlikely relationship with the mallard duckling. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Loons are super sleek with their black velvety head, their red eye, black and white checkered back, a white collar on the back of their neck, and a pointed bill. So seeing a mallard chick on the back of a loon earlier this summer caught researchers by surprise. And photographer Linda Grenzer is with the Loon Project. She's been documenting a loon pair and their adopted mallard duckling since June.
This is their child. Yeah, it's their chick. And they're doing everything they can to protect it.
Have you spotted a loon where you are? What was it like seeing one in their natural habitat? Do you have a fascination with loons? What do you want to know about them? Join in at 800-642-1234. Loon Project Director Walter Piper stays with us. He studies the territoriality of common loons. Let's go to the phones now. Jane joining us from Suamico. Hi, Jane.
Good morning. I'm thrilled to call in and talk about a pair of loons on Crystal Lake. Your speaker's probably familiar with Crystal Lake in northern Wisconsin. And the community has come to protect a pair of loons that mate pretty regularly on the lake, and they have a raft. They put milk jugs around it to protect it as the pair is raising their chicks. And this summer, I had the lifetime thrill of being down on the deck near the water with family members, and the parent loons were with their two chicks that were muddy brown and kind of ugly looking, but they were making their way around the lake, and the parents were feeding the babies just like he was describing, and they came next to us within 100 feet, and we sang for them. Oh. And they hung around for 4 or 5 songs, and it was amazing.
What did you sing?
Oh, old family favorites. Just kind of soft harmonies. My 89-year-old mother and I sang with each other, and they hung around for 4 or 5 songs. It was just fantastic.
Walter, this community protects their loons. What do you think of that?
I think that's great. By the way, Crystal is one of my study lakes, and in fact, the people who maintain that raft are have named the two loons on the lake, Walter and Catherine, and so we banded them earlier this year. Yeah, it's wonderful to see people step up and support loons. I mean, people love them, and most folks are really, really respectful and love the sounds that they make and the peculiar behaviors, the diving, and that is a nice tame pair. That's a bird that on Crystal that we banded as a chick in 2006. So he's a 13-year-old male, and that's a female that we banded on Deer Lake, and she moved over several years ago from Deer Lake. I'm speaking of Catherine, that Crystal Lake female. So yeah, they're I had a nice interaction with that same. The same pair, and they are really nice and tame. And
Jane, you need to say hi to Walter and Catherine the next time you come across them.
I sure will. My mom will love to know they're named. Thank you so much.
Well, let's talk about the iconic call that loons make. Here's what it sounds like. What are loons doing when they make this sound?
You know, it's interesting you should ask that. The folks, I guess, often look for a single simple explanation for any behavior, like a call that they hear. And so the book on that, what you'll hear if you go to websites or talk to folks about that, is that that's a call that that loons used to say hello to another loon nearby, and it is used as we'd call that a contact call. Behavioral ecologists would call that a contact call, and you do hear that call when loons get separated. But that call, which is called the whale call, by the way, is also one that loons use to signify danger. That is, when an eagle flies overhead, you also hear the whale call, and it's also used between parents and chicks, to not just adults, but parents and chicks. It's also used as a mate advertisement call. So you'll hear a loon that is alone on a lake. Perhaps it's been driven off of its own lake, which is a constant problem for loons. Rather than mating for life, they constantly are having to fight tooth and nail to hold on to their territory. So if they're driven onto a lake off of their own territory, onto a lake where they're all alone, they'll use that whale call to try to advertise that they are alone, and that they're happy to be joined by a mate.
Well, what do we know about the relationship between eagles and loons? Because you've been looking at whether loons can talk to eagles. What's going on there?
Well, they do talk to eagles, but it makes it, I don't want to make it sound friendlier than it is. Loons and eagles are really arch enemies. If loons and mallards are rivals, and don't like each other under most circumstances, loons and eagles really hate each other, because eagles, of course, are opportunistic feeders, and they'll gobble up anything that's not keeping an eye out for it. But so loons and eagles But yes, loons, that whale call that loons give, I did a recent blog post on this, and loons do appear to be, it's pretty clear that loons are signaling to eagles. They're in effect talking to eagles, but they're talking to eagles with that call in order to announce to the eagle that they have spotted it, and that there's no point in that eagle trying to attack the loon because the loon has already seen it. So you could see it, oh, this is a communication, but it's not a friendly communication. It's almost a warning that an attack would be fruitless and a waste of energy.
Back off.
It's in everybody's best interest. I see you. It's in everyone's best interest just to go about your way and leave us alone.
Well, Gary from Iron River emailed to ask, how will it work when the birds need to migrate south? What are the flying skills and the habits of loons?
Well, loons normally care for their chicks for a longer period of time than do mallards. And so mallard ducklings often usually fledge at about 50 to 60 days. This mallard duckling is, as I noted before, only too happy to accept the extra parental care it's getting from loons. And at last report, it's on day 70, still hanging around with mom and dad, and foster mom and dad, and it's now flying, circling the lake. But instead of circling the lake and leaving and going off to find others of its own species, it circles the lake and lands next to foster mom and dad. But when it, you know, loons and mallards are both migratory, so we expect that this duckling, despite its weird upbringing and the fact that it's imprinted somewhat on loons, will ultimately find other mallards. Of course, there's so many mallards around, a very common species, that other mallards will find it. It will find other mallards and probably imprint on its own species ultimately, and migrate south in a normal fashion. We don't know. This is the first time we've ever had an opportunity to look at this, but we suspect that will happen.
Well, in the last few seconds that we have with you, as Jane had called in and talked about how a community is helping protect their loons, what can people do when they live around their own lakes and they see loons? How can we make their habitat better?
Well, I would say just be respectful of loons in terms of listening to what the loons are telling you. You play the whale call, and the whale call is often given to humans as a sort of a mild indication that the loons are unsettled in your presence. The tremolo call, the laughter-like call, which is one that you often hear in horror movie soundtracks or just nocturnal soundtracks, that tremolo call is an indication of intense alarm. And so when people hear the whale, when they hear the tremolo and they're approaching loons, listen to the birds and realize that you got to give them some space and help them reproduce as well as they can under the circumstances.
Walter, thank you for joining us.
Sure. Nice to be here.
Walter Piper is the director of the Loon Project, studying loons in northern Wisconsin. He's a biology professor at Chapman University in Orange, California. You can see a slideshow, by the way, of the loons with the mallard duck. It's all at WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, we take a trip back to the era of leg warmers and VHS tapes to learn more about the 80s film teen genre. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.